From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh has been digging deep in the cloak and dagger world of the CIA and beyond for the inside story of how the case was made for invasion of Iraq. Tonight on Point, stovepiping and the story of the intelligence gap that led to war like you've never heard it before. Begin in Madrid, where the first day of an international conference on Iraqi reconstruction funding has ended. The meeting, attended by delegates from 78 countries, was called to spread the cost of the $55 billion that the UN and IMF estimate is needed for Iraq in the next 5 years. Rula Khalaf is covering the meeting for the Financial Times. I asked her how the first day of the Madrid conference has gone.
What happened today was that the American delegation, the Iraqi delegation, were seeing others and trying to convince potential donors to make contributions, and even those that have already pledged money to increase their contributions.
What was the tone of the meeting in Madrid, Rula? Was it receptive to the American request or cold?
I think you have to differentiate between two sets of countries. There are many countries that want to help, and that will be very obvious tomorrow. But the political differences over Iraq, whether it be before the war or after the war, these differences persist. And therefore, you have France and Germany, for instance, who have been very reluctant to come in with any substantial contribution because they think that you must have first a legitimate Iraqi government. So the political differences over Iraq are playing a big role in this conference.
What were U.S. officials saying today about the reception they're getting with their request for funds?
U.S. officials were quite optimistic. They seem to think that they will get more pledges tomorrow. They've been talking to Arab states in the past few days, and the only region, let's say, that has not announced its pledges yet is the Middle East. So I think there is an expectation that Arabs will come in with contributions. The question, of course, is going to be at the end of the day is how much of what we will be told tomorrow will be in grants, what will be in loans, what will be in kind, for instance, humanitarian assistance. I understand that some Arab countries want to give directly to Iraqis rather than through any international mechanism. They prefer to try to work directly with the Iraqi private sector or to send goods to Iraq directly.
And what yardstick are people holding up against the pledges that are gathered in Madrid? Is it the $55 billion overall estimate of what it's going to take or the $5.6 billion that the World Bank says could effectively be spent in the next year?
It also depends on people who are very supportive of this conference and people who are not so supportive. Tomorrow, I'm sure people who aren't very supportive of the conference will say that the yardstick should be $55 billion. Others say, of course, that cannot be the yardstick because there is only a limited amount of money that you can in practice spend in Iraq in any case. And this is the first donor conference. So the argument that American officials make, for example, is that there will be several other donor conferences possibly, and that as long as you get enough money to get started, that the point of this conference is to at least get the donor community to pledge enough to start the reconstruction effort and have enough money for a year, perhaps 2 years. And then more money will probably come in, and that clearly will depend on what happens in Iraq during this time.
Of course, the U.S. Congress is still looking at the details of the $20 billion that President Bush has requested for reconstruction. Are American officials in Madrid portraying that sum as ready to go, as a sure thing, or still with some question mark over it?
What we hear is we, the U.S., have contributed already $20 billion. We know, though, that this $20 billion will be there. The question in Congress is going to be whether this is going to be partly loans and partly grants. So American officials here are playing it as the U.S. has contributed $20 billion.
Paul Bremer, the chief authority, civilian authority there, today compared Iraq's situation to that of the Weimar Republic in Germany after World War I. We read, he said, it's a fragile democracy settled by unpayable debts. And he said, remember that Hitler was elected in that kind of situation in Germany after World War I. The point seemed to be we need fewer loans and more cash grants. We even need debt forgiveness. Is there talk among the major holders of Iraqi debt of forgiving that debt? It's hundreds of billions.
This donor conference is not about the debt. The debt issue has been postponed until next year. But what the Iraqis are telling us is that they want to start negotiations in any case. You see, there's debt with France, Russia. there's Paris Club debt, but there's also debt to Arab countries, which I'm not sure the Iraqis recognize in full. Saddam never did, in any case. And I think that what they want to try to do is to start talking about the debt, although they know that a full settlement of the debt is not going to come until next year. Ideally, what the World Bank says is you would have come to this conference having already settled the debt issue because, you know, some donors don't want to give money and then see it being paid to some other country.
But overall, does it look like Washington's officials are going to be able to come out of the Madrid meeting saying that they've succeeded?
I think they will say that they have succeeded because I think that they will get enough to spend for a year and maybe even 2 years. This is the prediction of, let's say, independent people who are watching this conference. It won't be anywhere near $55 billion, but it'll be enough to get started. And I think this is what the American officials said to expect in the first place. So I think they'll be quite pleased. At least today, they were gearing themselves up to be quite pleased tomorrow.
Rula Khalaf is a reporter for the Financial Times. She spoke with me from Madrid. As the case for war in Iraq evolved and changed, so did the intelligence that was used to make it. For months, the airwaves were filled with accounts of weapons of mass destruction and Iraqi nuclear programs pushing toward building a bomb. Post-invasion, those weapons and programs have not been found. Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine, has chased down the inside story of intelligence gaps, overrides, and manipulation that cleared the way for war. Tonight on Point, we'll hear what he has learned. How's your confidence in American intelligence reports holding up post-Iraq invasion? Do you trust that the White House is getting it straight and giving it straight? Do you still remember the case for war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and New Yorker magazine writer Seymour Hersh. He's been called the hardest-working muckraker in journalism, and he's still at it this week. Good evening and welcome, Seymour Hersh.
I've been called other things, too.
No doubt. Loudly. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Cy.
Hello, Jack.
Cy Hersh, take us into this, if you will. There's a remarkable story that you're telling this week of exactly how intelligence was picked up, used, amplified, and we want to get to that. But if you'd start with this systemic change that you say came in with the Bush administration, even before 9/11, a kind of change in the order of how intelligence was gathered up and funneled to the top levels of the U.S. government. Could you describe that for us?
Sure. The idea that raw intelligence from an agent, let's say somebody who's a defector from Iraq or somebody like that, raw intelligence normally is, in the American community, is analyzed and assessed and looked at and studied before it's passed on to high officials because obviously you don't want to be misled by somebody with a specific agenda. And we now know, by the way, that, of course, the Iraqi National Congress, led by Ahmad Chalabi, certainly produced an awful lot of very bad intelligence. What this administration did that I discovered only in talking to people in the last few months was before 9/11. By the middle of 2001, by June and July, they had changed the system, the way the mechanism for handling information that was sensitive, particularly about Saddam. Anything that was critical of the Iraqi regime was the word, the internal word, the sort of the vernacular is stovepipe. Anything that people in the Pentagon in particular, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, the same old names, Cheney, the vice president, mm-hmm. the president, anything that was critical of Iraq wasn't put through the process. It was stovepiped directly into the leadership.
In other words, right from the bottom to the top, right from the ground level to the top levels.
If it met a criteria, a political criteria, and so you had a situation, one of the accounts I write about, I'll just tell it briefly, is somebody was doing a study of somebody who spent 25 years in the bureaucracy in the Pentagon studying problems, was doing a study of the assumption that was made. These guys came in with an assumption that Ahmad Chalabi, there was going to be a coup and Chalabi would be widely hailed by the people in Iraq as the new leader. And he just did a study analyzing that question, would he be popular? And when he turned in the paper, a senior official in the Pentagon, somebody who worked directly for Wolfowitz, made it very clear to him, we don't do that. We don't do those kind of options. There's no negative thinking. We don't want to know whether or not we're right or wrong. This is what we believe, and this is what we're going to tell the leadership. In other words, the idea of studying the issue and seeing if that assumption is right was dismissed, sort of what I guess you could call it an options paper. And similarly, in other areas, in the State Department, there were little fiefdoms set up. John Bolton, the undersecretary for policy, actually the undersecretary in charge of all arms control and other issues in international relations, a very important job, was a very conservative person. And he wanted his own intelligence shop, and he got it.
So you're saying that 50 years, you write, of this filtering and vetting of information to make sure that top officials were not misled by bad information was kind of pushed aside, and instead you had a stovepipe right from the bottom to the top. I want to come back and look at the implications of that systemically. But you've got a remarkable story in the middle of this reporting, Cy Hirsch, that goes back to this whole business of yellowcake, uranium, Niger, and whether or not Iraq was in fact pursuing a nuclear weapons program, which, as you say, boiled down to the most important argument for war. Richard Perle, as you report, rolled it out in November 2001 as the Taliban was being pushed out of Afghanistan, that this was going on. Tell us the story of how that got into currency.
Well, what it was obviously, after the victory in Afghanistan went so quickly, the war, that the neoconservatives, the people who really had an agenda, came to office with an agenda, and that included going after Saddam as a first priority, they immediately began talking in the fall of 2001, right after 9/11, right after the victory in the war there in Afghanistan, about the next step, Iraq, and Pearl was among those. And the way to sell Iraq to the American people, the most dramatic way, and by the way, I think people believed it. I think they had convinced themselves throughout the bureaucracy that the issue of that Saddam did still have weapons. Any intelligence to the contrary couldn't reach the leadership, and any intelligence that said they did was stovepiped up to the top. So you had a sort of a self-reinforcing mechanism. But the notion of a nuclear-armed Iraq was enough to make any war justified to the average American. Certainly to me, too. Nobody wanted the idea of Saddam with a bomb. And so what happened is the problem they had is there was no intelligence to support that. The United Nations had done terrific work for 10 years. Their most solid work was on the nuclear area, where they were able to conclude a group known as the IAEA, International Atomic mm-hmm. Energy Agency, based in Vienna. Most people know about it by now. They were involved recently with Iran. Mm-hmm. That group by 1997 had said, no way there's anything left. So they had a high threshold in the Bush administration. And son of a gun, after 9/11, every CIA station, and what I'm telling you now is just the assumption. I've been told this. I haven't verified this. But every station was asked to check around and see if there was anything available. I'm talking about around the world, all of our CIA stations, to check with their local intelligence officials if there's any intelligence about Iraq, nuclear weapons, etc.
And lo and behold, something bubbled up. But hold the details of that story. We've got to take a short break before we get into
sure.
that, Seymour Hirsch. But Jack Beatty, you read what Cy Hirsch is reporting here. You know how he probes. And what he describes is a kind of throwing over the chessboard of how things used to work. The White House came in with a new hunger. Did the CIA deserve to have its old systems thrown out?
Well, you know, Senator Moynihan, right after the end of the Cold War, called for the abolition of the CIA. And one of the reasons was he looked back at its history. I mean, let's just look at it briefly. I mean, Korea, they were wrong. Nothing on the North Korean attack of June 1950. Nothing on the Chinese attack in November. Bay of Pigs in 1961. Well, that was clearly flagrantly wrong. Tet Offensive, no warning about that. Fall of the Shah in 1979. Soviet invasion of 1980. The fall of the Soviet Union, 9/11. It's easy to see why anybody might think that this was not a very competent agency, and that the information, when it finally got up to the top, was somehow rendered ineffectual or inaccurate, or in any case, it didn't protect the nation against these shocks.
Giant changes, though, in the way intelligence was handled. Maybe some reason for those changes. We'll come back and look at the details with New Yorker contributor Seymour Hirsch. We're talking about the inside story of the intelligence gap that led to war with Iraq. Who's to blame for getting it wrong in Iraq, the CIA or the White House? And who do you trust, CIA bureaucrats, Dick Cheney, the Pentagon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker writer Seymour Hersh about the inside story of the intelligence gap that led to war in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Should heads roll for intelligence failures in Iraq? The weapons of mass destruction were not found. Whose heads should roll, if any? And if you were president, would you want your intelligence filtered or straight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Seymour Hersh, you were about to turn to this remarkable story that we've all kind of heard details of, but I had never seen in the detail that you present this week in The New Yorker, of how a story came to an Italian journalist about uranium, yellow cake, Niger. Please take us into that.
Yeah, well, it begins, you have to understand, and by the way, Jack's absolutely right, the CIA has done a lot of things wrong. They missed the Indian test, bomb test a few years back, mm-hmm. but they also do a lot of things right. So, you know, it's one of those if and ands. And what happened is, here the administration wants desperately to, in the early 2002, they want to make their next strike against Iraq. They want to sell it to the American people. They're looking for an issue that would work. And all of a sudden, they get from the Italian intelligence service, the acronym is SISMI, SISMI, mm-hmm. a three-year-old report, early 1999 report, that an Iraqi ambassador to the Vatican had gone to Niger, where Iraq had purchased uranium ore 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier. And had made a visit there. And this came in, this three-year-old report, and it was stovepiped. It was taken, there was also, the Italians also reported that one diplomat had mentioned that possibly the Iraqis were looking at buying uranium again, more ore. And if you're the White House, this is evidence, sort of fresh meat, the freshest evidence you have, that Iraq may be trying to reconstitute its nuclear capability. That's a very important word.
So it's unfiltered, it's unvetted, it goes straight to the top.
Well, it goes from – Cheney hears about it, mm-hmm. and then he calls – this is the chronology. In early 2002, he calls in the CIA and he says, what about it? Mm-hmm. And this is one time when the CIA was on the ball, and they said – nothing to it. There's no way to make uranium ore into weapons grade bomb material. You know, billions of dollars have to be spent. Big factories have mm-hmm. to be built. They can't do it. And anyway, they have war, and it's under the IAEA has seen it. It's under seal. It's been inspected. No way. He's not happy. He pushes them again about it. The point that's interesting is Cheney had the intelligence before the community did. He got it stovepiped. Then they send, under pressure from Cheney, they send Ambassador Joe Wilson to Niger in early 2002.
The CIA sends him. This is now famous, of course, because of the right. leak about his wife being an undercover CIA operative.
Valerie Plame. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Joe goes and spends 8 days there and finds there's nothing there, comes back and files that report. And you know what happened? Over the next 3-4 months, it didn't make any difference. What Wilson had reported, or the fact that the agency and also the State Department was very skeptical of this Niger piece of information, it still bubbled up.
Right. A lot of this we've heard, and now it starts to get really interesting when it comes back somehow for a second lap
right.
based on this Italian journalist's contact. Please tell us about that.
Well, what happens in by the summer of 2002, we're talking, the White House is talking about mushroom clouds. And if you remember, that's right before the congressional elections of last year, which the Republicans held under the Senate and House, and also the famous congressional resolution authorizing Bush to go to war. And so, and everybody on the inside, it turns out, knows from early 2002 that this president's going to war. We don't know that, but everybody on the inside, everybody who worked at the National Security, a lot of people I've talked to said, no yep. question, by February. So what happens is in the fall of 2002, an Italian reporter named Elisabetta Berba for a magazine known as Panorama.
Which is a glossy magazine. Picture magazine, photo magazine.
Yeah, it has, TNA, tits mm-hmm. and ass on the cover every week, you know.
Viva Italia.
Viva Italia. But also, you know, she gets this story. She has a source. And she's provided with 22 documents detailing how, guess what, Iraq really was trying to buy uranium, and this was hot stuff. The magazine she has is owned by Berlusconi, Silvio Berlusconi, mm-hmm. the prime minister, mm-hmm. who's the very marginal prime minister of Italy, is in so much trouble chronically.
But these are documents that she gets that purport to be like transactional documents. Is that
oh,
right?
Oh, totally. And not only that, more than transactional. They talk about the documents talk about a conspiracy among five or six rogue nations, Libya, Sudan.
But they're stamped and signed, and it looks like the whole deal is right there in her hands.
Exactly. She goes. She's first thing she's told to do by her publisher is to take it over to the American embassy, which she does. She probably shouldn't have, but she does. It's not her job to do that anyway. But she does go to Niger, and she finds, like Joe Wilson in the fall of 2002, these are useless documents.
Useless or then, forged, or she doesn't know?
She just knows they're wrong. They're completely wrong. They're impossible to sustain. The next thing that happens, of course, is that they show up in the president's State of the Union speech. If you remember, the president says in Africa they were trying to buy uranium from Africa. And also, even before the president's speech in December, the White House named the State Department named Niger in a document as the source of uranium. Obviously, the point being that they were bolstering their public claim that Iraq was trying to reconstitute its nuclear arms. What I write in this thing, I take it a next step, and I have to tell you, you know, obviously, I've been in this business a long time, and I don't do this casually, and if anybody knows the New Yorker checking process, I have people, I've been around a long of tooth, as they say, and I have people inside the intelligence community have been talking to me very critically about Bush for obviously since 9/11 and many years before that.
And they're telling you there was a kind of setup going on here that backfired. Explain that.
Well, they say very simply the group of very unhappy, dissatisfied, disenchanted former CIA, retired CIA operatives, members of clandestine services, had seen that the CIA fall in bad times by the fall of 2002. The CIA had sort of broken. The analysts of the CIA were beginning to tell the White House what they wanted to hear about Iraq. Nobody was stopping this war from coming. And George Tenet, the CIA director, was seen as very weak and more interested in keeping his job than in being straight. And nobody was telling the president what he didn't want to hear. Intelligence was being stovepiped all over. Nobody had any sense of what was the president was getting or wasn't getting.
And this was extremely upsetting to longtime CIA operatives, and they decided to do something about it.
They wrote the fake papers that were given to Elizabeth Burba. This is one account. I can tell you there.
This is the story you're getting, that they actually forged these things. They sort of got them into the system. With what purpose?
The purpose was really not to go public, not to have a public discovery of this. The purpose was that they knew, to be crude, as somebody told me, I didn't write this, that they knew it would go, these papers, once they got to the American embassy or to the Italian news service, they would be shared by our intelligence service. They knew they would be stovepiped, rammed up to the leadership, because they were the kind of papers that were getting rammed up to the leadership.
Irresistible.
And they would go through, as somebody said, like bad pizza. Mm-hmm. Nobody would analyze it. Nobody would verify it. And instead, they envisioned a meeting in which somebody like Donald Rumsfeld or Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy, would say, look, we've been telling you guys at a meeting, internal meeting, they would say to the CIA and the State Department analysts who've been critical of the Niger intelligence, they would say, we've been telling you this for years, now look at this, and lay down the papers. The problem with the papers, as we all know now, is they were terribly bad. The name of the ranking Nigerian official who signed the documents hadn't been in office in 13 years.
So they weren't even good forgeries, but their hope was that it would end up as egg on the face that would kind of smack some sense into somebody and say, we've got to stop this unfiltered intelligence stuff.
Slow down this rush to war based on unfiltered intelligence. That was the profound hope. Instead, it ended up in the president's State of the Union. It was a mess.
And so there really was no filter, and it didn't matter if this story is correct. And we can hear you hedging a little bit on it, not entirely sure, but you've got people telling you that this is what happened. Instead, it became a big log on the fire to go to war, another log.
Well, you know, the hedge is very clear. I know some things I haven't said, but I haven't talked to the people who did them. The person who's telling me is a peer, somebody who knows these people, but I will tell you, I was able to tell Elizabeth Burba things about what she did that she didn't know I knew. In other words, the information was as best as one can. You know, where would I go with this? Would I bet my life on it? Hell no. Do I think it's really worth looking at? And I can tell you something else very important. The FBI has been doing an investigation into these fake papers. The Senate Intelligence Committee asked them in March to begin such an investigation. And officials there, it just so happens I know somebody involved very at a high level. One of their theories is that it was an inside job, And I can also tell you that Elizabeth Burbo was contacted by the FBI in the last few days, obviously because of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she acknowledged to me that the person that gave her the documents was connected to an intelligence service. So we have something going on here that's strange. In any case, the bottom line is Elizabeth Burbo and Joe Wilson, both were able to discredit these papers very casually with one visit to Niger, and yet they end up in the President's State of the Union speech. Something is rotten in Denmark, no question about it.
It's central to the rationale, the justification for war. And, Jack, there's an incredible dynamic that's illuminated here of the CIA and the rest of the Bush administration really tangling with one another to the point that ex-CIA officers, if this is correct, would be ready to kind of try and trip up the administration to make a point.
Yes, to the point that apparently, according to Cy Hirsch, the CIA leaked to the atomic entity, the IAEA, the information about this forged documents. That's a leak to this agency to sort of after the President's State of the Union address. And then, of course, you have the remarkable circumstance regarding Ambassador Wilson of the White House. The president essentially did nothing about this. He didn't think this was serious enough to investigate.
This is the leak of Valerie Plame's name and her role in the CIA.
That's right. But it was George Tenet who took it to John Ashcroft. Now, that's really something. I mean, that's an investigation that may possibly go to the president's political staff. And yet Tenet took it to Ashcroft. And you can't help but think that in some sort of way there, that's the empire striking back and that Tenet finally finding some backbone here to stand up for his agency. But, you know, the thing that leaps out in Cy's article to me is the role or non-role of Condoleezza Rice, the president's national security advisor. She's been the subject of two very negative profiles recently in the Washington Post and the Financial Times. And in these profiles, people have said things candidly about her that you hadn't heard before.
Such as?
So the word that keeps coming up is mediocrity. The word that keeps coming up is that she was cowed by Rumsfeld-Cheney, that they had their own stovepipe going, and that she didn't really exercise any sort of monitoring, over that information.
Why pick on her out of the whole group, Jack?
Well, there's
many players here.
But she's the president's last sort of stand against this kind of information getting into a State of the Union address. And there's a nexus between Rice and the president. The president says he does not read the newspapers. He looks at the headlines occasionally, does not look at television. He relies on her for his information. Now, that puts her in an unusual position because the president doesn't seem to have independent sources of information with which to challenge anything she says.
And if she didn't spot the bogey, or if
Rumsfeld and Cheney ran around her, well, either way, it doesn't look good for her.
George is calling from Boston. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. I love your program.
Thanks.
I'm listening to the talk about the intelligence and the failed intelligence and gaps in intelligence, and I can't help but think that I think any discussion of intelligence is immaterial. I believe that George W. Bush and the Bush administration made the decision to go to war and that they searched for any possible justification, and I really believe that they deliberately lied to the American public in order to sell the public on accepting the war.
Well, that's essentially what Cy Hirsch is saying here, but you're saying strip away all the intelligence, but yet doesn't the intelligence matter at some level, George, because the war was sold in this democracy of ours on the basis of these assertions that there was a clear and present danger. There were nuclear weapons in the making. Richard Pearl said it on this show.
No, actually, I don't think so. Because I think that there was enough question about the intelligence to understand that these things didn't exist. Now, I'm not an intelligence agent, but I'm a thinking American, and I can look at this situation and I can understand that a guy like Saddam Hussein literally lacked the capability to launch an attack on the northern part of his own country. And then, how could I possibly imagine that this man could be a danger to the security of the United States of America, which is the most powerful nation on the planet?
Well, look at North Korea. They can't feed their people, and they've apparently got nuclear weapons. But let us pick it up, George, and thanks very much for your call. Cy Hirsch, how about it? I mean, you say in your article, you say the point is not that the president and his senior aides were consciously lying.
The point is, what George is saying sounds so logical. The problem is that you had a system where most of the intelligence community believed Saddam Hussein was a direct threat, that there were serious issues of – there were problems with his chemical warheads. We didn't know how many warheads he had of chemical weapons, of nerve gauge. There were problems with biological. What happened is – what I think happened is that any assessment that suggested that what George said, you know, that Saddam Hussein did not possess a threat to the United States, or did not seem to be a threat because he just – you know, we're America and he's Iraq, didn't get in. You had a system where only the information that they wanted to hear got to him because of stovepiping and other issues. And so to say they lied is really, to me, it's more frightening than they really did believe what they wanted to believe, and they were allowed to believe what they wanted to believe. In other words, they lived in – one of the guys in the CIA told me a wonderful analogy. It was too complicated to write. He said it's as if they went into a planetarium, these guys, and the software went bad. And so the Big Dipper in the sky they were looking at was not the real one. They went outside and they looked up and they said, what the hell's going on? These guys have
been
living
back in the planetarium.
And they've been living in a planetarium, been given the information they wanted to get. So what's worse, that they lied or that they really believed the wrong set of assumptions and of facts because the system was designed to make them believe what they wanted to believe?
But our country's future was in those planetarium stars. Mark's calling from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is a real interesting show. I was going to try to make an analogy between, you know, relatively principled decision-making in the White House, which, you know, you could say maybe took place in some previous administration.
Maybe.
And the kind of cooking the books and selecting intelligence reports that fit your goals and rejecting the ones that don't that's going on. I wanted to make a parallel between that distinction and the difference between a journalism program in a university and a public relations program. And, you know, in the academic world, we're seeing, you know, PR programs sort of encroaching on the space that was, you know, reserved for the journalism programs. And the difference that my students are seeing, and I'm not in that field, but I do advising for students who have, say, a minor in public relations.
You're saying everything is becoming public relations, everything around the information business.
Right, yeah, and that the students are seeing through the fact that at the core of it, the public relations concept doesn't have any, you know, ethics. It doesn't have any principles.
Yeah, spin is spin. Mark, our time is short. Let Seymour Hersh take that up. Seymour Hersh, what about it? I mean, first to this notion that this administration might play more fast and loose with intelligence than others. Does that have merit?
Oh, all administrations do. The only thing this administration did that was remarkably different is they didn't filter some of the sensitive agent reports that all administrations have been. And by the way, what Jack Beatty was saying about Condoleezza Rice is absolutely right on. There's just no question. She could have put a stop to all of this and insisted that all of the intelligence that the president and the vice president got was first analyzed and at least put in some sort of frame of reference. You have to know who's giving you, how reliable they are. None of this stuff was being done. So they did change. This administration did make a distinct change in the procedure. But all administrations, of course, look, we've had 10 years of lousy reporting about Iraqis' weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't something new to the Bush administration.
We'll come back and talk about that. This time the filters were all off. We're talking with Cy Hersh about the inside story of the intelligence gap that led to war. Who's to blame for getting it wrong? The CIA, the White House, and who do you trust now? CIA bureaucrats, Dick Cheney, the Pentagon, anybody? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, writer for The New Yorker magazine, about the inside story of the intelligence stovepipe that led to war in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Can the CIA and White House effectively fight the war on terror if they don't trust one another? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike's calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have
you.
Really
enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I had actually 2 points. I believe that there were actually 2 types of intelligence that the White House and the CIA was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
One was military intelligence dealing with, you know, weapons of mass destruction capability, Iraq's ties with terrorists and whatnot.
I mean, if you still want to give it that the respect of putting that label on it after what we're hearing tonight. But anyway,
well,
yes.
What they're claiming at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what
right,
they were claiming
right, got it.
There. And
got
I
it.
Think that that was an important point because after 9/11, you know, the U.S., the American public felt the need for action on the White House part. And I also think that given, you know, the White House sort of official strategy of preemptive action as written by Assistant Secretary Wolfowitz, they were just looking for enough military intelligence to sort of substantiate that preemptive
action.
Got
it. And the other vein?
The other vein, I think, is more of a cultural intelligence where, okay, the U.S. is going to be welcomed by, you know, the Iraqi people with open arms. We're going to be received well. We're going to be fully supported. And I think that that was kind of a naive outlook. You know, I think that now what we're seeing with reports of terrorists coming in from Syria and from Iran and the Shiite community having its own agenda that isn't necessarily supportive of the U.S. is showing that our intelligence was by no means adequate regarding how the Muslim community or the Muslim world, even though I don't really like that term, how they were going to necessarily respond.
No real hosannas for Ahmed Chalabi coming in, certainly, and not necessarily for U.S. troops in many instances as well. Mike, thanks for your call. Sihirsch, you gave us an instance earlier where options around that very thing of Ahmed Chalabi's return were considered and brushed aside. But I want to get to this deeper point of what you describe as kind of antagonism between America's very large intelligence establishment and the White House, the Bush administration, the Pentagon. What are the implications of that? I mean, is everything stovepiped if the CIA is sidetracked? How bad is the blood here? You're describing CIA veterans setting out purposely to bluff the administration, to trip it up, you know, to pull it into a trap. That's pretty serious stuff.
Well, you know, just the last caller, just for the record, this is one case where both the State Department's intelligence service and the CIA all predicted that there would not be rosy. So the idea that there was a lot of intelligence about what would happen, but it wasn't accepted. It didn't get through the filters that these guys had. It was only the intelligence they wanted to hear, which was about, you know, us being welcomed with open arms.
But is
it's
there,
horrible
is it,
right now.
But is there a fair perspective here where you look back at the list that you and Jack laid out of CIA failures over many years? Bush administration comes in. They already don't like that. As you said, Donald Rumsfeld was very dissatisfied with that. Then you get 9/11, and maybe they say, look, we can't wait around for these bureaucrats to gum up this intel. We've got to see it ourselves. Is that a natural response? Is that a credible response in the circumstances?
Well, this particular group of neoconservatives and very conservative people really came in with a tremendous hostility to the bureaucracy. They thought they were soft. Even in the Pentagon, they thought the military, the general officers were too Clintonized. We saw some of that just in Rumsfeld's memo that was leaked this week. There's a sense that we need tougher people. And so it went beyond just the notion of the various failures. There are always failures in an intelligence committee, although I acknowledge the CIA's had many more than they need. I wish they were better. But the bottom line is they also have they're a restraining force because often they have information that is right and relevant. And certainly about Niger they did, certainly about what was going to happen when we invaded Iraq. There was a story in last weekend's New York Times that it had been reported before about the State Department weighing in very heavily with the warnings about what would happen.
So if that real intelligence is permanently sidetracked, what does that do to America's antenna in the world? Does everything then become a political decision? Is there no such thing as a decision grounded in fact?
This is, you know, I quote a guy, a longtime CIA analyst and very serious guy, saying this is the worst government he's ever seen. We're at loggerheads now. There's a tremendous disparity.
Worst government meaning the conflict that it's got in the middle of it.
Yes, the point is that there's such enmity and hostility between what the White House wants to hear and what the intelligence community is telling it often. And often, by the way, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, is often just as in the middle of these kind of disputes, too. You don't hear about it as much. They were given the back of the hand very often by the Pentagon if they didn't report the way that the Wolfowitz and others wanted them to report. If you remember that, we know that the Pentagon set up its own special intelligence office about a year and a half ago, right after 9/11, because they didn't like what they were getting. And so you have this sort of madness inside the bureaucracy with the CIA's analyses being second-guessed by people like Cheney and others who, as bright as they are and as competent as they are, you know, they really shouldn't be analyzing intelligence. They should be relying on professionals to do so. They can disagree with it, but at least they ought to have the analysis. And what this group has done, it's cut out that filter. It's perfectly okay for them to ignore it and spin it any way they want, but they're not even getting the intelligence, the analysis, and some of this raw stuff they need to get.
That we're paying for with the CIA. Jill's calling from Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Well, the gentleman from Wisconsin calling about
yes.
the ethics. Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to say is that I didn't think at first, my first question was that I didn't think it would be possible in a two-party system to where deals are made at the top to where you know ahead of time what the answer is. I have a long history in consulting and contracting and things
like that.
You think
a one-party system is better?
No, what I thought of as he started talking about the ethics is mm-hmm. that in any system where you have people that decide ahead of time, I work in local government now, mm-hmm. and you have a selectman, a group of people who have decided that they want this new building or whatever it is. When it comes to the town meeting, they are everything is slanted towards that position. And no matter who comes with anything else, they don't want to look stupid, so they downplay all of the you know anything that doesn't agree with their position.
The cake is always going to be baked in advance, you're saying.
Yes. And so what we did is we got our own people in there, and they're doing the same damn thing.
Joe, we've got it. Seymour Hersh, we can all understand that to a certain point, and yet there's an element of hubris here or arrogance, isn't there? I mean, if a country feels that it's really living with real threats, doesn't it have to have some real information about facing them?
Well, yes. And, you know, the point is, and I don't mean to belittle what the last caller was saying, you know, this isn't about a selectman's, you know, decision at a town meeting, although that can be certainly as important to anybody as anything else. We're talking about an operation now that the last time I looked was $87 billion off the top with who knows how much more. Men, American boys dying every day, every week. I think 1,900 wounded right now. Going up, God knows what's really going on there because we're only getting fragmentary reports. And so the consequences of the actions of a president invading a country and beginning to pick a fight with 1.3 billion Muslims are pretty big. And, you know, and the notion that they would be dealing like the local town hall selectmen in the handling of the intelligence is also pretty frightening because I think that's the right analogy. These are guys with a predetermined mind, and they simply don't want to hear. Even in the case of the town meeting, though, the people can at least get their views made.
Well, then go out and look at the site themselves. In this case, it's on the other side of the world. Cy Hersh, you always crack open a new vista for us. We're out of time, but it's been great having you tonight. Thanks so much for your piece in The New Yorker this week.
And thanks to your callers. They were great.
Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize winner, investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine. Jack Beatty, I've got to say, all of this makes me turn right around and look at American journalism and say, man, oh, man, do we need it to be aggressive and well-informed? If we've got this going on inside government, you've got to have the Fifth Estate leaning in here, doing its job.
Absolutely. And here's where leaks are really the way in which the government now, one agency is signaling the other through leaks, saying, you're not paying attention to this. And it puts us in front of the public to say, well, what are we going to do about it? And, of course, all of this decision-making and this intelligence and these slip-ups, this is one of the things that's going to be on the ballot in the next election. The public may feel, well, it wasn't so serious. They may not.
Well, let's crank up the American press, too, and get out there and find out what's really going on. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Jack, stand by. In a moment, Saudi Arabia's Prince Bandar gives his second American press conference since 9/11. This is On Point. For only the second time since the September 11th terrorist attacks, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States held a press conference for American reporters today. Speaking at Tufts University's Fletcher School in Medford, Massachusetts, Prince Bandar bin Sultan said that relations between the United States and Saudi governments is as solid as ever, despite what some in the media are saying. But what worries him, he said, is American public opinion toward his home country. Here's an excerpt from today's press conference.
I worked with five presidents, from Carter to now. Carter before I became ambassador, and presented my credential to President Reagan. I worked with every one of them since then. Now, why am I here with you? I need you. Because there is a lot of garbage that your readers are having. My worry is not our relationship between our two governments. My worry is our strongest asset has been that we have always maintained that positive relationship with the American people. And 9/11 shook that. But I take very seriously when the American people think Saudi Arabia is not the same Saudi Arabia of old days, and they're not our friends. And that cannot be further from the truth. Now, we are many things maybe in Saudi Arabia. Politically stupid, we are not. I am here because the first 6 months, I was really shaken to my roots of what I've seen on 9/11. And I've seen everything I worked for between our two countries almost collapse right in front of me. Second emotion was, I was angry. I was angry, how can this happen? And why were there 15 Saudis members of that attack? Within a year from that time, we began to see people in Congress and in some people in the media becoming really preposterous vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. It became a national pastime. And it's not based on facts, because facts you cannot argue with, but things that are utterly not true. And don't forget those people who, those evil 15 people who did that criminal act in 9/11, they didn't sit and plan it in Tehran, Iran, or in Libya, or in Syria. They were in Frankfurt, London, Munich, etc. Why, when 2 million British people demonstrate against the America, the force, the military, the invasion of Iraq, nobody have given me a headline in one of these great news outlets and say, why do the British hate us? But if there are 10 people in Saudi Arabia found in a back alley, covered their faces, say, we hate the Americans. See, the Saudis hate the Americans. You know, what's the problem? So there is an intellectual arrogance, but also there's a little ignorance. That's a deadly combination. Unfortunately, in this country, I am always surprised how shallow sometimes the analysis or how simplistic it is. I wish it was that simple, because we would have had solved our problems a long time ago. It's not that simple. My family is not a holy royal family. We don't come descendants from the prophets or something. Nor are we a ceremonial family. We are a peasant royal family, but we are working royal family. We're politicians like everybody else. And I've learned, make your words soft and sweet. You never know when you have to eat them.
Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, speaking earlier today at Tufts University's Fletcher School. To listen to the press conference, visit our website at onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, there's an ambassador with a big challenge. We didn't get to hear anything like the whole speech there, but I'm afraid I have to say I didn't hear him getting this whole issue over the hump. I mean, this is as serious as it gets. It's not just about light attitudes. There's a lot to be dug into here.
Yes. For example, there's that joint report of the Joint Intelligence Committee with its, 26 redacted pages about the connections between, or alleged connections between, Saudi Arabia, civilians or a government, we don't know, and 9/11. That's a black hole for them. They want to make that public, but do they really want to make that public? And then, you know, some of the things we've discovered. We've discovered that a member somewhere in their government, I think the propaganda cultural agency in any rate, had connections in Hamburg with Mohammed Atta. We read that there were connections between a member of their government and one of the hijackers in San Diego. Now, maybe these didn't amount to anything, but this is very serious stuff.
Not just a few guys in a back alley, or even if it were, you kind of want to hear him stand up and speak to why those few guys had an awfully big impact. The world's still reeling from it. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
We'll keep listening on that front. Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.